Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the Local News Hour this morning, I'll be talking with Steve Itzowit, Director of Resort Planning at Deer Valley Resort, along with Rich Wagner, who's Vice President of Development for Alterra Mountain Company. We'll be talking about the plans to develop the snow park parking lots. Then the chairman of the Oakley City Planning Commission, Zane Wolstenhume, talking about the commission's CUP, conditional use permit approval for the Newport Academy there at the site of the old Oakley School up Weber Canyon. Finally, Julia Duran, the director of 2640 Multicultural Marketing, talking about the interactive multicultural awareness workshops that have been designed for corporations and nonprofit organizations. Well, short-term rentals were at the center of Park City's opposition to a piece of state legislation aimed at tackling the state's affordable housing program problem. KPCW's Sean Higgins has more on that.
House Bill 82 was passed by the Utah legislature on the closing days of the general session earlier in March and was signed into law by Governor Spencer Cox on March 16th. In short, the bill is intended to allow for more accessory dwelling units and single-family homes like basement apartments or mother-in-law units. The idea is those units would then become an affordable rental option for people looking for housing but are not in a financial position to buy a house of their own. Park City initially came out in opposition to the bill, not because they were against the legislation's intent, but because there was nothing to prevent these units from instead becoming short-term rentals like those found on listing sites like Airbnb and VRBO, something the city claimed would only make Park City's shortage of affordable workforce housing worse. Through the legislative process, amendments were added that allow a municipality or county to punish individuals who offer certain units as short-term rentals. Critics of the bill, including those in Park City, said the legislation is a one-size-fits-all approach that does not take into account the unique circumstances of a major tourist destination like the Greater Park City area is. The hard part, says Park City Economic Development Director Jonathan Weidenhammer, will be finding those illegal units. He says unless an illegal rental is complained about or obviously listed on a rental website, they can largely fly under the radar.
I think to a degree it's unclear what that means, but the way one could read that is to say, but if no one ever applies and we don't have the ability to find them through internet advertising, short of a series of complaints about noise or parking or garbage, it's going to be hard for us to ever find them. They won't be visible. They won't be apparent to us.
The city has said there are roughly 5,000 short-term rentals in Park City and 2,000 units considered to be illegal. Weidenhammer says the city gets to that number through a surprisingly simple method, cross-referencing rental listings on websites like Airbnb and Craigslist with the city's list of businesses registered as short-term rentals. Short-term rentals can be a big moneymaker for property owners. Nightly rentals in Park City are regularly listed for $100 or more per night, and giving that income up or reducing it in favor of a long-term rental could be a hard pill to swallow. So, will HB 82 make an impact in Park City? Right now, that's still a little uncertain. The language of HB 82 leaves punishment largely up to interpretation. Weidenhammer says currently the city sends a letter to a property owner operating an illegal rental encouraging them to obtain a business license, which costs a few hundred dollars. Registered rentals are taxed just like any other lodging business in Park City, collecting sales tax and transient room tax, which is charged to any overnight stay under 30 consecutive days. There are also benefits to becoming a registered rental, including access to the resources of the Park City Chamber Bureau. CEO Jennifer Wesselhoff says registered rentals could make more money, and tourism throughout the area would become a better experience for renters and locals.
I mean, we would ultimately really like to communicate with those hosts in order to help provide them resources for their guests, whether those are visitor guides or maps. And I mean, part of sustainable tourism is really about influencing visitor behavior once they're in the area. So the more we can touch and communicate and educate our visitors once they're here, the better visitor behavior I think we can expect.
Weidenhammer adds that one part of the bill Park City was pleased about was requiring these new units to be part of an owner-occupied residence. For example, a homeowner in Park City would be allowed to rent their basement apartment out for the year. Weidenhammer says this will help prevent second homes in the city from turning into nightly rentals.
We understand nightly rentals are very lucrative, but we also understand that oftentimes the people who are accountable for that maybe don't live in town or they live in another state or whatever, and it can be difficult. So one of the important things that was kept in House Bill 82 was the requirement that these additional dwelling units be owner-occupied. That was a big game changer. We're very happy about that.
With Governor Cox signing HB 82 earlier this month, the bill is now law in Utah. A link to obtain a business license in Park City can be found on our website, kpcw.org. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
KPCW News Time now, 8:15. Good morning. Well, as we've reported, Deer Valley Resort planners have been meeting with the Park City Planning Department as it prepares to submit its application for the parking lots there at the base of the Snow Park Lodge. In the studio with more details, I have the resort's Director of Real Estate and Planning, Steve Isowitz, as well as Rich Wagner, who serves as the Vice President of Development for Alterra Mountain Company. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Leslie.
Steve, let's start with you and get a little bit of history of the Deer Valley MPD approved back, what, in the late 1970s?
77, yeah. Been a little while.
Yeah. So what's kind of, I know things have changed over that time, but what did that approval allow Deer Valley to do?
So that approval was our initial, development agreement with the city that gave us the resort, all of the homes that you see today, and what we're here to talk about, which is the snow park base area. So everything from chairlifts and the ski runs, the operation of the resort, down to the real estate. And so we're a little over 40 years here, and it's been a long time coming for snow park, but we're getting pretty excited.
Yeah, how does an MPD actually last for 40 years? I mean, is it just something you have to renew?
Well, so each project in the MPD then goes through a conditional use permitting process. So those are the ones that have more of an expiration date, if you will, when you get your approvals, and then by the time you start construction and see a project through. But the MPD is controlling pretty much for the life of the resort, since it gives us our approvals to operate as well.
So is this the last bit of development then that Deer Valley has?
Within the Deer Valley Master Plan, yes. This is pretty much the last parcel. There's a few that have been sold over the years, for example, like the Huntsman parcel. They still have some development rights that they will build on. But as far as what Deer Valley owns, this has been the very last piece.
Okay. So what does that vested development there in the, six parking lots, what does that allow Deer Valley to do?
Yeah. So it's roughly 210 residential units. And then it has the remaining commercial for the entire MPD attached to it. So it's roughly 20,000 square feet of commercial. And currently in the code, there's also allowances for what they call resort accessory use and support commercial, things like that. But 20,000 square feet of commercial is very small, so we're trying to figure out how to best utilize all that. And we're super early in the stage. So we came in today, mostly I wanted to introduce Rich coming onto the team here. He's been a great addition for us, and we're super happy about that. And we just a couple weeks ago submitted for an amendment to our MPD to make sure, since things are a little bit old, just to knock the dust off, make sure the language is good and that we're all on the same page before we start moving forward with a lot of expense with planning and architecture.
Sure. What does that amendment ask for?
It really is just a language clarification to discuss things like the commercial space, because just this past year the city was looking at amending the code, so we want to make sure we understand all that. There's some language in there about employee housing. As most people know, Deer Valley built all of our housing up front when we first started, and so just making sure we're all tightening up language and agree with what's in there.
Yeah. So this approval happened very close to the time that we saw the approval for the Treasure Hill development. And we all know what a mess that approval was. What we thought was going to be a 450,000 square foot development morphed into more than 1 million square feet, with the Sweeneys saying that they were entitled to that much development because of the accessory use, the support commercial, the so-called back of house square footages on top of the density approval. So do we have what that 210 units looks like? I mean, are they based on a certain square footage?
Well, there's always hallways and closets and mechanical rooms and things that have to go into a project to make it work. And the way the code is written, those are allowances above and beyond what the actual, residential square footage or the commercial square footage is. When you look at an example like Treasure, that I'd say was a pretty extreme example. And when you get into very large scale hotel buildings, those square footages tend to grow quite a bit. And I'm not sure we're going to see anything quite to that level here, but it will be, you know, we will need hallways. We will need mechanical spaces. So I can't tell you today what those numbers are because we're not anywhere near that part of the design yet. But yeah, those should be things that are expected to some degree.
All right. So what are we talking about? I mean, can you tell us what you're thinking now at this point? I mean, are we talking about three-story residential units with maybe some of the commercial and skier services on the bottom, or?
Yeah, so I'm probably a little premature to try and talk too much about what the actual plans are, where the buildings will be, and kind of how it's all going to look exactly. But our MPD allows for a 45-foot height limit. We're not looking to go anything above that. We're not even sure if we're going to build all the density that we're entitled to. So we're kind of just messing with design. And I think what Rich will probably help explain here is this is something that's been in our plan for 40 years. And, you know, we've tried to get started on it multiple times in the past. The one that everybody sort of remembers is 07-08 when we were working with Turnberry. All those applications were in. We had a pretty solid design moving forward. And then the market crashed, and that kind of went away, luckily before we put any shovels in the ground. And so it's kind of been a long time coming, but this is really a project that we are asking for at the resort. You know, Deer Valley has always needed a base area. We kind of struggle with just having a parking lot, and, you know, we rely very heavily on our guest surveys each year and consistently, even though we're arguably the number one resort in the country, those are the areas that we can always stand to improve. So having après-ski, having some sort of village, you know, having a better entry, those are things that have been on our list. Edgar and Polly were excited back in 07 and 08 to get that moving. Edgar unfortunately passed away right after. But, you know, it's the big regret now is that they're not here to kind of see that come through to fruition. So we at the resort are all really excited about it.
All right. Well, Rich, let's bring you to the microphone here. I mean, so is Park City home now for you for a while?
Yes, Park City's been home for 3 years, a little over 3 years.
Oh, okay. Yep. So you're working out of this space. I need you closer to that mic.
Sorry.
Yeah, thanks. As opposed to out of the headquarters.
There. Correct. Yeah, I'm not out of Denver.
Ah, okay. So Alterra, of course, was interested in buying the resort for this development potential. I mean, are Alterra's ideas on par with what Deer Valley has been thinking about?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say that Alterra bought Deer Valley for development potential. I would say they bought Deer Valley for the resort itself. I mean, it's arguably one of the best resorts in the nation. So I think they bought the resort for that fact and the operational revenue potential that Deer Valley brings. Development, obviously, is a catalyst to help the operational revenue side, but Alterra is not necessarily a real estate development group. I mean, they're an operational group, and we're always looking to increase operational revenue. For example, we have a commercial element within Snow Park that we really think is a great community benefit. And I don't want to get into too much detail, but we're out of commercial square footage, but it's going to be a great community benefit. It's going to be a great increase in operational revenue growth down the line, but we can't do it. So we're going to take roughly 60,000 square feet of residential space and apply it to this commercial community benefit element. I mean, that's at a $1,200 a foot. That's a lot of money that we're just, I don't know a real estate developer that I've ever worked for that would do that. So just trying to make a point there.
Yeah, so we're talking about now 80,000 square feet then of commercial development. Is that what you're...
So we have our allotted commercial. Yeah, we have our allotted commercial per the MPD. We're going to actually take our residential UEs and apply those and convert those to commercial. So we're going to forego residential profit and apply it to commercial community benefit.
Yeah, Bob Wheaton had talked about what was envisioned at one point was basically bringing the resort base of the resort closer to the parking lot. So does that then mean we've got the kind of the whole demolition then of the where we got the buses coming through on top and then the people walking through where the tramway is?
Yeah, I'll speak to that for a second. So we had lots and lots of meetings over the years about kind of how we want the future village and the parking to really integrate better with the snow. Obviously, where the road is located and potential bridging and all sorts of things, it creates a lot of difficulties and separation. So what our goal is as we move forward to try and design, to your point, Leslie, like, do we bring the lifts down further? Do we alter Snow Park Lodge in a way that makes it more integrated with the village? Does the tunnel go away? All those are things that we probably have to figure out and answer on the fairly short order here. But I think the answer is yes. Our goal is not to just have everybody come through like a dark garage and through a tunnel and then show up in the snow. You know, Bob and I always discussed that we'd want people to get out into the light from the parking, if you will, and up onto the plaza level and then flow through the plaza to where the lifts and snow park are. So hopefully that would be a much better seamless experience. And with the grades and everything and how we designed the garage, that would hopefully be a nice, fairly flat village.
Okay. So the idea then is to do the underground parking?
Yes, for sure. There's no secret or magical way to to put the cars somewhere else. So it would be underground parking. It's luckily the site is very contiguous, so it's all, you know, one kind of giant rectangle, if you will. And it should allow for a very good, smart design. I know other areas where you look and there's, you know, challenges with existing development kind of in the middle, and you have buildings and existing garages that you have to go around. So there's a lot of utility challenge with the site in general, but on the whole, it lends for a pretty good blank slate, if you will.
Yeah, certainly one of the challenges, though, is how do you build deep holes and tear up parking lots and then run a resort? So what are the plans for that?
That's a tough one there. Obviously, we gotta keep the resort operational. So as soon as we start engaging a contractor, get them on board, we'll start talking through phasing plans and how we work through this. It's going to be very difficult, Leslie. I'm not going to kid myself. But, you know, I've worked on other ski resort development projects, and we were able to do it. And granted, you know, it is construction. It is disruptive. So, but we'll try to make it the best experience for our customers as we can.
Yeah, and you were asking about history before. So, you know, in 2015, we did, under Mayor Jack Thomas, he put together a study for us to work with the University of Utah, the School of Architecture and Design, and the students all came in and did this really cool competitive project and then presented at the end of the resort. And there were a lot of really cool ideas that came out of that too. So that was a lot of fun. But we had the same discussions with all those groups is, you know, and what I've talked to Rich about quite a bit, and what Bob and I always talked about at length was, you can't screw up winter, right? Like, that is uber, uber important. And there is, like, to Rich's point, there's no easy way to do it. So it has to be extremely well planned, very well coordinated, and then, you know, ducks kind of have to fall in a row there for it to work out well. But the goal is that the resort, this is a project for the resort. It's an improvement that we're all wanting to do to the base area. At some point, we're going to have to, you know, break the eggs and get it going, and hopefully it all works out well and we come up with a great project for both our guests and the community.
Yeah, and certainly part of the thinking way back when was that if Deer Valley had an agreement with the Mayflower Mountain Resort, you'd have a bunch of parking over there, and yet we still don't have an agreement with Mayflower. Is that still in the works? I mean, that could make a big difference here, yeah?
Yeah, it could definitely make a big difference. We are definitely communicating with the Extel group, and the parking itself would be available to any operator that came in. So it's available to us if we make a deal. It's available to any other operating group that would come in. But yes, I mean, I can't really get too much detail on that one. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, Deer Valley also, I mean, you guys have always prided yourself on capping the number of skiers. What I'm not hearing is any more lift access up the mountain. So if we're adding more density here, does that mean that You guys sell fewer local passes? I mean, are you saving the skiing then for people who actually stay at Deer Valley?
Well, our caps have always been really based on restaurant space, inside interior space on bad weather days and things like that. When we have decks open, you know, our numbers shift a little bit where we allow extra skiers. So as far as uphill capacity and mountain capacity, we're very underutilized, if you will. But that being said, especially with the pandemic and the efficiency of the lifts this year, people, you know, you can see that in the morning there are lines at Snowpark. And so part of our discussion is that we improve both Silver Lake Express and Carpenter. What exactly that means, don't know right now. One may be a gondola, one may be a six pack. But our goal would be to improve the experience coming out of the base area for sure.
And as we all know, Deer Valley Drive, of course, a very narrow old town road. How many more cars can you really bring up to the resort before you've just, I don't know, the neighbors revolt, or, you know, you just, or you have gridlock. I mean, we certainly see that with some of the concerts. And
yeah, I have to probably think and be respectful in my answer. The roads were designed for all of the density that's in the MPD, and there's not additional density that's ever been added. And so I think it would be fair to say that the roads were designed to handle the capacity. I know we hear things that probably speak, not quite in line with that. But regardless of you know, how we think the road flows today and how many more cars it can take, there's obviously going to be traffic studies and engineers that are involved to show how all that will work with the additional density. And then the biggest thing that we're all trying to move forward with that we haven't really spoken about is transit. And so with that being such a big item on the city's list to steer people towards, which is great, and we're all kind of jumping in with both feet on that, we want to include a very well-designed new transit center, and we've been working with the transportation folks at Park City on how that's going to look. But then obviously the bus system's going to need to be improved quite a bit. And when we talk park and rides and, you know, transit only lanes coming in and out of town, those are all things that we kind of get excited about and we hope happen so that we can reduce the amount of traffic coming in and out.
Yeah. And I know the city has been pretty pushy about it, saying, you know what, if you guys paid for parking, we'd push more people onto the buses. Once you build those $100,000 parking spots underground, will it become then paid parking?
I don't know if I guarantee it. I'm going to look at Rich here, but
yeah. I mean, we're investigating. Oh, sorry, we're investigating at this point. That's about all I want to say about it.
But you're right, Leslie. We've been asked for a number of years as a resort to really consider that, under the belief that, you know, if we were paying for parking, that would reduce the amount of, whether it's single occupant vehicles or just make people think a little bit more about taking their cars. And personally, I agree with that. I think we've seen it in other areas around us. But when we say something as bold as paid parking may be instituted, there's a lot of people that don't like that either. So we have to be very thoughtful on how we do that.
All right. What's the timeline here?
I'm going to look at Rich.
I'm looking at Steve.
Good luck.
Tell me. No, I think timeline is obviously a dartboard shot right now, but what we're going for is a CUP submittal, which we're working hard on. So once we get that, then we'll submit that, and then timing from there is dependent on how the CUP process goes.
Mm-hmm. So you think before the Planning Commission, though, at least this year?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right.
And that would be a CUP really for the garage structure itself first. This has to be built kind of in stages, you know, and there'll be phases even with the garage, but the first stage is really the base, right, that buildings and the plaza could then go on top of. So there's a lot of intricacies to that. Obviously, it's, in a quick radio broadcast, it's hard to really explain how that all the steps kind of flow, but there's a lot of work involved. Our goal would be to just at least get the process going. So that, because we know it will take a while going through the city approvals and have lots of meetings. Our first step is we want to meet with neighbors and kind of show them what our plans are once we have them, and kind of make sure we're talking to everybody we can.
Okay. All right, I've got to leave it there. Steve Isowitz and Rich Wagner, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you, Leslie.
It's 8:35. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, the Oakley City Planning Commission last Thursday approved a conditional use permit for the Newport Academy that plans to open up a new school for troubled youth. On the phone with details, I have Planning Commission Chairman Zane Wollstonehulme. Good morning, Zane. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you, Leslie. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you. Can you just start by reviewing the history of the Oakley school site? I mean, it was originally built for a similar purpose. The school then closed and been closed for a while now, I think, yeah?
It's been closed for several years, as far as I know. I was out of town for several years, so anyway, it's been closed for as long as I've been back to Oakley. Opened up about 1999, and it was servicing a special population of kids who had special needs from around the country, and operated, I think, under a couple of different owners over the course of several years, but it has been closed for a few years now.
All right. So you held a public hearing the week before the Planning Commission actually took action. What was the sentiment of the public?
You know, it was mixed. We had a few people speak out who were kind of opposed to the idea of that opening back up as a school. But generally speaking, it was supportive.
Yeah. And how many residents are we talking about here? Because it is a kind of a live-in situation for them.
Right. So under the conditional use permit, it's anticipated that they would have about up to 60 residents at any particular time.
All right. And
initially,
I
think the plan is they'll probably open with 10 or 12 or 15, but they would have capacity for up to 60.
All right. And are we talking high school students or younger?
Adolescent. So I think we're talking, it's called out specifically in the conditional use permit, but I believe we're talking about 13 to 18-year-olds.
All right. And in terms of the ratio of staff to residents, I think that is probably set by the state as opposed to any condition that the Planning Commission would set, yeah?
So they are bound by state law, and under the law, that ratio is like one staff for every four clients. So considerably greater staff ratio to clients than was there with the original school.
All right. Now, the Newport Academy itself, are they an accredited school?
Yeah, and they do business. Well, they can get accreditation, but they do business all over the country, providing these kinds of residential treatment services for adolescents.
All right. And are they restricted from admitting anybody or with perhaps a significant criminal record?
So anyone that has a felony against them is exempt from participating, as well as anyone that has any kind of record of sexual criminal problems.
All right. And in terms of the hours of the facility, I mean, it's basically 24/7, yeah?
Yeah, it's a live-in facility, but the curfew hours for the clients is 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. And they can never leave the premise without having a staff ratio of at least one person per four clients.
All right. And then in terms of security around the building, they'll be required to staff that?
So, yes, we will have great lighting, and they will actually have someone in charge of security watching the gate going in, from what I understand, and then sufficient security personnel on site to help them manage the clients.
All right. And my understanding as part of the approval is that a community advisory group will be formed to work with the town. So what does this group do? I mean, is it chosen by the city of Oakley, or is it something that Newport puts together?
So we're calling this a good neighbor agreement, and I think it's going to address some concerns that were brought up by the community. But this group, outline will consist of at least one representative from the treatment center, and then up to perhaps four community members, assuming that there's enough interest in participating. And the idea is that as issues may come up, that we can tackle those head on before they become problematic for anybody, and make sure that we have a good relationship between what we hope will be a very successful business in town and the community.
All right. Planning Commissioner Doug Evans was hopeful, although it wasn't a deal breaker, that the Academy could offer access to perhaps local kids, maybe some kind of outpatient care. How did that get resolved?
Well, we ended up not making it conditional for approval, although their services, I guess you would say, are available to anyone that qualifies. So we could have local community members as clients, assuming they meet the qualifications. It is a little different than the Oakley School Agreement. When it first opened up, they actually provided scholarships for local kids that wanted to participate, and there were one or two kids that actually did that. But we included it in the draft, but we ended up pulling it out as we felt like we really shouldn't be dictating to Newport how they should do their business.
All right. So other than, I guess, some maintenance work, I mean, the facility is pretty much ready to go, yeah?
Yeah, my understanding is like in the last year that the owners have sunk a lot of money into bringing the building up to speed, and they've done a lot to make it useful for their purposes. And so we appreciate the investments that those folks have made.
All right.
To make sure that it's good.
Yeah. And this doesn't need to go to the city council, right? Unless the council were to call
it
up?
That's correct. That's right. Okay. It doesn't require approval of city council, although they are certainly aware of what we're doing and what we've done here with regards to this conditional use permit.
All right. And does the Academy, do they plan to work with our mental wellness group, Connect Summit County?
Yeah, I think they specifically will be working with anyone in the county that's involved with mental health, and hope to be a partner, I guess, in meeting the needs of the county and communities within the county. So I think it'll be a good thing.
All right. Zane, anything else you wanted to mention about the Newport Academy?
No, we're really excited that Newport has come to the fore and that we'll be able to open up that beautiful facility and make use of it again.
Okay. I appreciate your time, Zane. Thank you.
Thanks, Leslie.
That's the chair of the Oakley Planning Commission, Zane Wolston, here. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. News time now, 8:44. Public comments at last week's meeting of the Park City Planning Commission brought up the greater issues related to transit in the Park City area, like ever-increasing traffic, efficient bus routes, and satellite parking lots. KPCW's Sean Higgins has more on that.
Although this week's discussion about the proposed base development at Park City Mountain Resort was focused on transit and traffic circulation at the resort base, it's clear to anyone who has tried to get around town during rush hour that traffic is not a problem unique to the resort. Cars routinely back up throughout town on peak ski days and holiday weekends, and commute times can easily double getting in and out of town on State Route 224 and 248. During public comment at Wednesday evening's Planning Commission meeting, Baja Cantina owner Stephen McComb highlighted the need for a more holistic approach to transit. He said with his employees competing with resort guests for parking, a better way to not just get people to and from the resort, but to and from Park City itself is needed.
Where are the people going to park to get on the bus? I mean, we got the people coming from in town, but what about the people coming from out of town? Where are those parking lots? Where do people access the buses? We can concentrate on the transit, but if the transit, if the buses are going to share those lanes of traffic coming into town, it's not going to work. Where's the big plan?
Park City Mayor Andy Bierman highlighted the issue of traffic and transit during his State of the City event in February and told KPCW that Park City's geography is partly to blame for the city's traffic woes. With Park City surrounded by mountains and only two year-round roads in or out with little space to expand, creative solutions are a necessity if traffic is truly going to decrease. An expansion of the park and ride near Quinn's Junction, as well as a repaving project on State Route 248 to create dedicated bus lanes, are expected to get underway in the coming years. The city also studied the feasibility of a future aerial gondola system as a way to potentially move people around town. Bierman said those types of solutions will be what the city is looking towards in the future.
Some things I think we've talked about is large park and rides on the outside of town, and whether we bring people by bus, by rail, by aerial in from those to the core of town and move people around internally with microtransit or, again, one of those other forms of transportation.
How Park City will integrate with Summit County's newly formed transit district and future bus rapid transit system will also be a challenge to take on going forward. Discussions surrounding the development of the base area of PCMR are expected to continue through the spring, and city discussions about transit in the greater Park City area will be a central topic throughout 2021. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
KPCW News time now, 8:47. Good morning. Well, 2640 Media has launched a new interactive online workshop to help organizations better connect with the largest minority in the United States. On the phone with details is the development director, Julia Duran. Good morning for you. Good morning, Julia. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Leslie. Thank you for having me.
So first, why don't you just tell us a little bit about 2640? I mean, who are you and what is it that you guys do?
Yeah, absolutely. Passion is for people is the centerpiece of 2640 Media. We're a team of experts, the three of us. We're a boutique marketing agency dedicated to creating authentic, respectful, and effective multicultural marketing strategies for organizations in the area of healthcare, nonprofit, and education. Our agency specializes in implementing digital advertising, web development, graphic design, and, of course, we're a women and minority-owned business.
So it sounds like you do have some expertise in reaching and engaging the Latinx population specifically?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So two of my team members have worked with organizations like Intermountain Healthcare, the Muhammad Ali Foundation, NFL, and others. I personally have led efforts in Park City to bring together Latino entrepreneurs to advocate for themselves in the area and support each other as they build businesses in the community through a nonprofit locally.
Okay.
So that's a little bit about us.
Yeah. So you've developed this interactive online workshop, and tell us you've got a couple of local organizations who've actually participated in it?
Yeah, absolutely. So back in January this year, I heard that Park City Community Foundation was looking for content for an upcoming nonprofit roundtable. It had been canceled by the co-host, and so I called Maddie Shear. She leads those conversations and pitched the idea to put together my team's expertise into a workshop that was tailored to Park City nonprofits. So after that, we found great success. The RSVP list, I guess, was the biggest since the pandemic started in about a year ago. So that was really an exciting effort. And shortly after, the director of Connect Summit County, who's a client of ours, she asked us to deliver that same workshop to her board. And so that's kind of how it all got started.
All right. So what happens during a workshop like this?
Yeah, so basically we connect with the organization that wants to put on the workshop. We learn about, you know, the organization's history and sort of the goals, how do they see themselves in the next year or so engaging with Latino audiences. And so based on this, we tailor workshop topics based on their needs. And some of those topics include what does the landscape look like in Utah, in Summit County, in Park City? Just really understanding the demographics. We talk about intercultural awareness and why it's important. What are some of the barriers that some of the organizations have faced in authentically reaching this community? We talk about cultural assumptions, transcreations versus translations. What are the differences? Cultural differences and commonalities, and how can we use the commonalities in the Latino culture to really create narrative structures that engage that community and that really resonate with that community. And then finally, we then go into action steps and how can we cultivate that cultural awareness in the organization and start building those genuine relationships in the Latino community that are essential to making the community part of the organization.
Yeah. So I guess of those organizations that have done this, I mean, what are they telling you that they have gotten out of it?
Yeah, absolutely. So the organizations that have done the workshop, one of them was Swanner Eco Center. She was one of the participants at Park City Community Foundation's roundtable. And the biggest takeaway was they had a list of questions that had been waiting to be addressed for a long time. And those questions were addressed. Other nonprofits said that they really now have a general idea of where to start. We conducted a survey before the workshop, and a lot of nonprofits just don't know where to start. They don't want to be insensitive towards, the communities that they might not be familiar with. And so learning more about the community itself really sort of helped them understand what were some of the ways that they can start building those relationships.
All right. So for other organizations that might be interested, I mean, how much does something like this cost?
Yeah, so we can do a workshop up to 60 participants, and that could be either, several board members, or it could be different partners coming together to do this for their organization. And the cost is $1,500, and you get three experts that then go in and learn about your organization and tailor the workshop to that organization or those organizations' needs.
All right. If somebody wanted more information, how do they get a hold of you guys?
They can find us online at 2640media.com. And if they want to learn more about the workshop, it's just 2640media.com/workshop.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to tell us, Julia?
That is all I had for you. We're very passionate about this topic, so if you'd like to speak with us, we're happy to just do a short phone call. And, one of the things you'll learn in the workshop is, as Latinos, we like to include all the details possible, and we're talkers. So, we might connect with you on a 20-minute basis, but if you'd like to kind of have some questions up front and just are curious about it, we're happy to engage with you longer.
Okay. Julia, I appreciate your time this morning. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
Julia Duran, again, Director of Development for Multicultural Marketing, 2640 Media. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Well, as the state of Utah nears the set end date of the statewide mask mandate, health providers are preparing for potential risks. KPCW's Jessica Lowell has more on one state healthcare system's plans.
A bill that was signed into law this legislative session ends Utah's mask mandate April 10th. Dr. Mark Breesocker is a physician executive with Intermountain. He says with hundreds of new cases every day, Intermountain hospitals and clinics, including Park City Hospital, will continue to enforce masks.
The most important thing that we think about at the beginning of every day is how do we keep our patients safe and how do we keep each other safe? And while there's been tremendous improvement from those really tough days in January, we have to remain vigilant with respect to infection control, especially in healthcare facilities.
And as COVID-19 variants continue to spread throughout the state, he says healthcare officials will continue to watch transmission rates and hospitalization and death rates to determine if they need to take more precautions.
So is there risk? Yes. Are we going to be watching everything very carefully? Yes. And as we develop evidence of trends or develop insights that we feel we have confidence in, then we'll be sharing and talking about those.
He says Utah has been able to get ahead of the spread of variants due to the state's smooth vaccine rollout. With vaccines opening up to all Utahns 16 years or older, venues have started to plan out concerts and large-scale events for late summer and early fall. Breezocker says it's important to continue to think of the pandemic as a marathon by still remaining vigilant while moving forward.
I think it's fine to celebrate the victories that take place along that run. You know, I think it's good for a community to especially our communities, to feel good about how we've responded. And I would say the word again, and I've used it before, is let's stay vigilant. Okay, let's not lose our edge.
While the statewide mandate ends in about 2 weeks, he says people should continue to look at mandates on the individual level.
What replaces it is the personal health mandate that we all do every day to remain distanced, to wash our hands, to stay masked, stay safe. As we're in this transition period out of a pandemic and into more of what's this, you know, how are we going to live with this virus for the long term?
He also says as more people get vaccinated, they should look after their general health and schedule appointments that were delayed due to the pandemic. Jessica Lowell, KPCW News.
Residents in Heber City want to preserve the night skies in the Heber Valley. Staff is implementing the needed steps, which includes regional cooperation. KPCW's Carolyn Murray has an update from the recent Wasatch County interlocal meeting.
Heber City Manager Matt Brower led the discussion, explaining that the Heber Envision 2050 message from residents is loud and clear. Night skies are a priority, and the city is ready to draw up an interlocal agreement on the initiative. Attending the meeting were elected officials and staff from the Wasatch County government and municipalities. Brower said it wouldn't work unless everyone is on board.
So Heber City has put a strategy that has really three areas of focus. First is to put an ordinance in place that would require all new development to comply with really best practices for preserving the night sky. And that's been done. That's been put in place by the Heber City Council. The next part of our strategy is to begin looking at the existing lights and how we can retrofit them to come in compliance with night sky requirements. And then the third leg of the strategy is partnering with our local community members, Midway and Wasatch County and others, to make sure that we all have the same ordinance.
He said the Night Skies Initiative wouldn't require residents to retrofit their lighting. They'll budget to upgrade streetlights and outdoor lighting on city facilities. Brower said the interlocal meeting entities, including Wasatch County Council members and Midway City officials, gave a warm response to the Heber City Dark Skies Initiative. Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.